Well, thank you very much indeed, Mr. Black, for allowing me to come and talk to you about your family's history in the hotel trade. Could I just ask you, please, your full name and date of birth for the tape?
Rosalie Black, 1704-28.
Thanks very much. And I believe before you were married, you were a Ranieri.
That's right.
Now, your father, was he the first to be involved in the business in the family?
Yes.
Now, he came over from Italy. Can you tell me a bit about how he came to be involved?
He came from Italy to work in England and then joined the British Army. And it was when he came out of the army at the end of the war that he first came to the Isle of Man and bought, first of all, one boarding house, and then over the years that turned into six, and then they became all joined up, and that became the Alexandra. That was divided into six houses, as they were called, Kent, Victoria, Marina, Central, Queens and Crescent. And on the first floor, first bedroom floor, there was a corridor went straight through the whole lot. But after that, every house was divided, so that there were six staircases going up from the first bedroom floor. And gradually over the years, those were all connected up, and eventually a lift was put in, so things became a lot easier.
Your father sounds quite an entrepreneur. What did he do before the war?
Well, before the war, he would be in Italy with his family. He was only about 17 or 18 when he came to England. So I have no idea, really. I think they were a farming family.
And how did he get the money to come into the trade? Did he rent initially, do you think? Or?
Well, in those days, people were very good about lending money to people. And I know he had some money from a Mr. Marshall, who was the owner of Shimmons Garage, which was next door but one. And after that, I suppose the money he made bought the next house.
So can you tell me the name of his first house again was?
Was the Alexandra.
Right. And so he kept that name when he developed?
When he developed the others, yes.
And can you recall how soon it was when he started buying more hotels? From the very first?
Well, I was born in 1928, and by that time he had bought them all. So I would say over a period of about 9 years.
And was your mother involved in the trade very much as well?
Oh yes, my mother took charge of all the catering side, while my father ran the upstairs part of it.
And would you be born there yourself?
Well, born in the Jane. Yes, I went, yes, yes.
Could you just go back and in your mind's eye, because I know the buildings have now been demolished, can you tell me what it would be like just to go back into the main entrance? I'm going to shut that door because the fridge is humming.
Okay.
If you were to walk in the season into the main entrance of the Alexandra, what would you see and what would it be like?
Well, there's a brochure here, which if you look at it, shows, as I remember it, because I was only 10 when the war broke out. Which, as you can see by our standards, was a little bit gaudy, but that was the thing in those days. And the rubber floor was considered very, very modern. Those were in the days when there were no lifts. And the main staircase went up there. So that was the place where people came in through the front door, came to the reception office, and in those days the porters carried the luggage upstairs. You were not in those days expected to carry your own luggage. The porters did that. So that was a reception hall. And then you went through to have meals in the dining room, which, as you can see, and I don't think we were any different to other people in those days. There was no stainless steel cutlery. It was silver. The tablecloths were beautiful white linen, and the napkins. Everybody was the same. We were no different. But people did look after the visitors. And if you look at the meal times, you can see it was full board, both lunch and dinner at night, and afternoon tea was included. And if you had 350 people staying, 325 of them would come back for afternoon tea, which was taken in the ballroom, if you turn over. During the daytime, this floor was covered by carpet, and there were little tables and chairs in here where people sat and had their afternoon tea. And then the night while the people were having their dinner, the porter's job was to roll the carpet up and then left this floor for dancing. And there was dancing every evening. The Bee Gees' father started off at the Alexandra. He was the dance band leader.
What would it be like, the atmosphere, when they had the dancing?
Oh, absolutely packed. Absolutely packed. It was very, very popular. Some people went out, a lot of people went out to, say, the Palace or the Derby Castle in the early evening or to the pictures. But by 10 o'clock at night, they would all be back and everybody dancing.
Was the entertainment within the hotel one of the attractions of the Alexandra?
Yes, I think so, because, of course, we had a live dance band always, and there were cabarets. I can't really remember the cabarets, but the dancing went on until just about midnight. And then, generally speaking, people went to bed. They weren't really rowdy. There was very little nastiness about. And, of course, we had the police who walked up and down the promenade, which you don't see so much these days.
And how many guests would you take when the hotel was full?
Oh, about, well, it says 400 in the brochure, probably about 380 or 390.
And how many other hotels in Douglas could take that number?
I don't think there were any. No, there wouldn't be any who would take that number. The only bigger place would be Cunningham's Holiday Camp, and, of course, that wasn't the same sort of thing.
Was your father aiming for a large hotel or a high-class hotel, or, you know what I mean, where was
he? No, middle of the road. Definitely middle of the road. My father's aim was probably to buy up every hotel in the Isle of Man. But we stopped him.
What was he like as a man?
Well, people thought a lot of him. He kept himself to himself very much. He was very keen on golf, very keen on dogs, bit of an eccentric. When war broke out, he went, because we didn't have the hotel, because they'd taken it then for internees, and we went to live at the Douglas Bay Hotel. And he went to Ramsey one day and bought 6 hens, and that turned into a poultry farm for the rest of the war. But he was the sort of man people came to ask advice from. And, as I say, he kept himself very keen on knowledge. He used to think the National Geographic magazine was the best thing that ever came out. And he demanded absolute punctuality. You couldn't say to him, yes, I'll come and do it in a minute. You had to do it straight away. And there was no, in those days, and there again, I don't think we were any different, there was no familiarity with the staff at all. They never called any of the family by their Christian names. But he was very good, because before the war, I don't know how many years, maybe for 4 or 5 years before the war, he taught young boys how to, wait on in a dining room. He worked with the Manx Technical College, as it was known, and the Tech. And he had a class of maybe 20 boys every winter who would come down and he would teach them. And he offered to do it again after the war, and they didn't want it then. They'd moved on, so.
So even though the hotel was a large one, you closed in the winter?
Oh, yes. Yes, everybody did pretty well. We closed straight after Manx Grand Prix. And then we opened again about the 20th of May.
And can you recall how the season would build up and what the pattern of visitors would be like?
Yes, May would be quiet, then you'd have the TT races, and then June would be quiet, and then from about July the 2nd it would start to build up. And the two very busiest weeks were the last week in July and the first week in August. And it stayed busy right until about the 23rd of August. And then it just got quieter. Manx Grand Prix was not a huge success, shall we say, as far as visitors were concerned. And then we'd close about the 15th of September. I'm very pleased to see them all go too.
It must have taken a lot of staff to have run such a large establishment.
We had about 50. We had about 50 staff. We had quite a few porters because, as I said before, people were not expected to carry their own luggage, and we had either two or three page boys who used to, because there was no tannoy system to begin with, they would have to go through the public rooms if there was a phone call for anyone. And then I think there were about 15 waiters, about 10 chambermaids, and then the rest would be in the still room and in the kitchens. And you had a pan man who did nothing but clean pans. You had a potato man who did nothing but peel potatoes. And you had a staff maid who looked after the staff, somebody who looked after the linen, a housekeeper, about three, four receptionists. It built up to about 50.
And would they all be taken on at the same time, or would you take on some of the staff early in the season and then some late?
No, there were quite a few Irish staff. And you would probably have, well, we did have, this is just after the war, two particular families who came from Ireland, probably about 10 in all, and they would come about, oh, February, early February, start spring cleaning. And then the rest of the staff would come in bits and pieces until it built up.
And were you working in the hotel as soon as you left school?
Pretty well as soon as, by the time I was about 17, yes.
And what did you start doing initially, your first?
Oh, the bookings and the clerical side of it and the banking side of it, that sort of thing, yeah, office work.
And what would your working day be like, the sort of tasks you'd have to do?
Well, I would go down probably about 9 o'clock in the morning. And then depending on which day of the week it was, Friday night was the day that most people paid their, well, it was the day that everybody paid their bills. So Friday you might not come home until about 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning. It was hard work, but in those days, all the staff, they all worked in the morning, then they either worked in the afternoon or they worked in the evening, one or the other. And there was no such thing as set hours for staff. They just did their shifts. And everybody seemed very happy.
So you employed staff on a shift system rather than by the hour or anything like
that? Oh, there was nothing, no question of by the hour. No question. They came and they worked in the mornings, and of course the waiters would work lunchtime and dinner time. But the chambermaids were either on in the afternoon or they were on in the evening. And that was the way it worked right through the hotel pretty well. Kitchen staff, of course, were there each mealtime.
Did they live in?
Yes. They lived in rooms in the basement. And we had one or two little attic rooms where they lived. Yeah, they didn't have... it wasn't nice for them. But it wasn't nice for us either. I think everybody sort of along the whole promenade in the summer, they just lived where they could. Because it's always been a short season in the Isle of Man. I mean, in those days there was no such thing as the rugby teams coming over or anything like that. I don't think anybody started much before May. And everybody was finished by the end of September. So it was a very hard life.
And when you were working in the office in your first job there, did you get a sense that your father was training you up for the business? Or how did you feel about... attitudes towards the hotel as a young person, and how did they maybe change over the years?
Well, the attitude never changed. It was just something that you did, and I don't think I remember really learning anything. You knew it. You'd been brought up with it, so you knew it already, and there wasn't an awful lot to it. We had what was known before. This was before the days that charts came in, and we had what was known as the bed book, which was a very big loose leaf book with all the bedrooms in it. And you simply wrote the names in and followed them through until they left. So that by having the book open, you knew in an instant whether there were any rooms empty. And the thing to do was to juggle it so that you never had any rooms empty. So people, generally speaking, were not allowed to come any other day except Saturday. That was the day everybody came. If they came on a Friday, they had to be prepared to sleep in a different room for the first night, usually. But pretty well... The boats would get in at about 4 o'clock in the morning onwards. And if we had say, 300 people coming in, 150 of them would be over at the hotel by 5 o'clock in the morning. And the whole bedroom, the whole ballroom would be completely full of people just sitting around with their suitcases. And then they were given cups of tea and they went into breakfast. And then it was just a matter of trying to get the people out of the rooms so that you could clean them and get the other people in. And it was absolutely chaotic. But I don't think anybody refused to take them in. Everybody did the same thing. But those were in the days when there were, I don't know how many boats there would be. Boats just came and went the whole time.
Did you enjoy Saturdays or did you hate them?
I hated the whole lot. I never enjoyed it at all. You did it because it was a duty. It wasn't the sort of small place where you ever sort of really knew people. You didn't know people and you really didn't particularly want to know them. Some of them were very pleasant. I don't remember any sort of nasty situations. The staff could be troublesome. You'd have chambermaids who in the middle of August would say, well, they were very sorry, but they were now going home to see to the harvest. And then you'd have to try and get more. But generally speaking, the staff were very good and very loyal. And everyone, if there was a problem, everybody would muck in and help. But I can't say I ever enjoyed it. I enjoyed the organisation side of it. I enjoyed it before the first visitor walked through the door. But as I say, you never really got familiar with them at all.
What was the trick to organising it that you were able to, you know, manage the organisation well? What methods would you do to make sure it all ran smoothly?
Well, the letters started to build up coming in round about beginning of January. The busiest time was probably the end of February and beginning of March. And we had a system of going down to the post office to collect the mail and bringing it back. This is all to get the letters out the same day as they arrived. And you might have anything up to 60 letters a day, and then you would sit down and you would have the bed book in front of you. But to begin with, it would be my father who had the bed book and me who sat next to him. And he would go through the bed book and say, yes, you can offer them this or you can offer them that, and I would write it down, and that would be passed on to the girl who was typing. And then gradually I started doing the bed book. And that was the trick, of course, on how to make money, is how to make sure that you didn't have empty rooms. And so things, you just gradually learned how to do things, and then you did the bills and the bar takings came in. But there wasn't a lot, really. It was all very much sort of managed by the top management rather than other people having a hand in it.
And how many people would be sort of management? There'd be yourself?
Obviously. Myself and my husband towards the end and my father. That was it. Nobody else. We did, at the very end, we did try having managers when my father wasn't too well, but it doesn't work. It just doesn't work at all. All the hotels were managed by the family. I don't know of anyone who had a manager, because they're not keen enough, they're not interested.
And a long day?
I mean, to begin with, my father and I would take it in turn to be off in the afternoon or off in the evening. And then when my husband came in, I had an easier time because I had the children. But they would take it in turn to be either on in the afternoon or off. But as I say, I can't say I enjoyed it.
Would the family meet the guests, or would that be something that you let your staff do?
No, the staff did that. I would be in the reception office, but I mean, they didn't know who I was. And my father, they would go and talk to him and he would talk to them, but you'd never sit down and have a drink with them or anything like that. And I don't suppose they wanted to either. I mean, they were mainly young people, so they didn't want to particularly talk to the person who owned the place or anything like that.
So how did your clients differ from those of the small boarding houses? I mean, you mentioned they were mainly young people. Now, some of the landladies have said, oh, it was families, we just took families, we'd never take young people.
We had young couples and young... to be quite honest, I can't honestly remember, but... I suppose families would tend more to go we had sort of more young married couples and young children and this sort of thing. Quite a lot of single people. But my father was extremely strict. If he had any idea at all, and he had porters. He had porters who walked along the corridors when they went to bed at night. And if he had any idea at all that there was a boy in a girl's room, the porter was sent up. And they were asked to go. My father has asked people to leave because of that. So it was very, very strict.
So do you think they thought, oh, it's a big hotel, we'll get away with pretending to be married and things like that?
Oh, no, this would be couples. Two girls in one room, two boys in another room, and they'd think they could go and visit each other. But they didn't get away with it. It was quite funny, really, I suppose, looking back on it. I mean, never, I don't think, did we ever have an unmarried couple stay. They either came two girls, or three girls, and then three boys. But I don't think anyone would even have thought of trying to get away with it.
What about drinking? Was that a problem? Was that allowed?
Yes, we had a private hotel licence, so it was just for the people who were staying in the hotel. And they drank, but there again, I don't remember any real problems with it. Not like these days. No, it was people were much nicer, I think, in those days. Yeah.
And would you allow the bar to stay open as late as the visitors wanted, or would you shut it?
I think there were licensing hours. Yes, I think there were licensing hours. I can't remember. Certainly it never stayed open after midnight. I think probably the licensing went on until midnight and it would be closed straight away. Most people just went to bed.
So it sounds like respectability, was that something your father felt was very important?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes. Yeah. I don't know, really. We kept to ourselves quite a lot, I suppose. But he used to try and make people think that he was not the owner. He would sit in his little office, or if he was walking through the hotel, he would limp. He would put a limp on. And if somebody said anything to him, he'd say, "Oh, I don't know, I'm just a night porter." He didn't want to really have a lot to do with it. He loved the organisation of it. But none of us loved the people, really.
So when he pretended to be the night porter, was that because he didn't want the bother, or was he a shy man?
Oh, he was shy, fairly shy, yes. Yes. But very, very, very good with staff. And the staff were very, very loyal to him. The waiters, there would be about 12 of them. And towards the end, when it was difficult to get staff, when it became difficult to get staff, they came from Italy. They came from a school like our college here, they'd come from there and they'd come over, and this would probably be their first job. But they were good, they were very good. And now we get reports of some friends of ours were in Cape Town last year, and they happened to start talking about the Isle of Man, and the manager of the restaurant had been one of the waiters at the Alexandra when he was a young man. Yeah. And the Irish staff who came to do the spring cleaning, from the time they left in September until the time they came back, had never eaten meat. So they used to be glad to get back. And they used to write and ask to come back. The sooner they could come back, the better.
Would they be from the countryside or
yes,
from the town?
Yes, from the countryside, probably, yes. But you had the same staff. Everybody was the same. You had the same staff year after year after year. Because they all came back to the families they knew.
Did your father ever find, being Italian, that must have been fairly unusual at the time on the Isle of Man, was it? Did he ever have any problems with other landladies?
No.
Being rude, or were they friendly?
Oh, no. No, before war broke out, have you heard of, Deemster Cowley? Friend of Deemster Cowley? Well, Deemster Cowley was a friend of my father's. And he advised him to take out Manx nationality, because up until then he had been Italian, you see. So my father took his advice and took out Manx nationality just before the war. So he was left alone during the war.
He could have been interned in his own hotel.
He could, yes. I think they wouldn't. I think they wouldn't let him join the Home Guard or something like that. But this is when he started up his poultry farm at the Douglas Bay Hotel, at the back of the Douglas Bay Hotel. So he had plenty to do. Yeah.
Now, you were born in 1928, so you'd remember the war breaking out as a young woman.
Yes, and vaguely. Well, I was 10 or 11, actually.
Can you remember what the family said and what they felt as you had to clear out the hotel that day?
No, I can't remember, but I've been told that literally the hotel just cleared. You know, all the visitors, all the staff, they just literally went. And my brother and his friends, I think a couple of weeks before, I hadn't joined the Territorial Army over here. So the first real thing that happened was all the Manx boys went away to the army. And then we stayed. I can't remember how long we stayed at the Alexandra, but not long at all. And then we went up to the Douglas Bay Hotel to live, which was empty, of course, again, completely empty. And I always remember the night of Dunkirk. Suddenly, we were inundated with about 300 men who wanted feeding. They brought them to the Isle of Man. And I think my father was out on the golf course anyway. They sent for him. And my mother managed it. She fed the 300. And then after that, the army was billeted up there. I think there must have been the guards who were looking after the internment camps. And we left. We went down to live at a little place at Switzerland. So, but I'll tell you what's very interesting. I mean, if you go to the museum, I went once to look something. Am I still talking too much?
No, I'm just checking it's working.
Went there to look at something else, actually, and found the old newspapers of when war broke out. And it's very interesting to read what they were going to bring evacuees over and put them into the boarding houses, and to read what they were going to pay for those evacuees. And I think it was 2 shillings a day, and what they were to be given to eat. And that's very interesting.
And what would your parents have been getting from visitors per day?
I think when I first went there, it was about 8 and 6 pence. And I think by the time we finished, I think it had just gone over about £1 a day, something like that.
Just thinking about the economics of the business, you don't think it's a rude question, but just because it's all gone now, I mean, you must have seen the figures when you were working in the office.
Yeah.
I mean, can you tell me a bit about the money side of the hotel, how things would run? Maybe, can you tell me how many rooms would have to be occupied for the hotel to make a profit, in terms of maybe what percentage of the rooms?
Oh, I don't know that I could. We always made a profit. You see, you were pretty well full from about beginning of July until the third week in August. My father always used to say, now what did he used to say, that up until the end of June, or was it August? Up until the end of one of the months anyway, that was paying the bills, and after that it was profit. But certainly everybody always made a good living out of it. But I couldn't tell you that. But I mean, I think, we were full for maybe 7 weeks, and half full, or three quarters full up until then. I mean, you know, you've seen the figures of the number of visitors who came to the Isle of Man. And pretty well in those days, they did all come to Douglas.
You must have been spending a huge amount on food and supplies to feed them all.
Well, that part of it I didn't have a lot to do with. I suppose so, but I suppose the food used to pour in. We didn't have our own laundry. Stuff went to Klugas's laundry. But I can't really remember. I didn't have a lot to do with that side of it at all.
Who would be managing that sort of those economies?
My father. My mother would be doing the ordering of the food, and the chef. They would do it between them. But it would be my father probably who paid the bill. I probably paid the bills, but I don't really remember them at all. But, I mean, things were so cheap. You know.
Can you remember who'd be supplying you and what they'd be supplying?
Yes, James Kissick would be supplying all the groceries, and with Cretneys on the quay. They would do the supplying of those. It would be presumably Heron and Brearley who did the drinks. Conabares, I think, did the vegetables. Isle of Man Dairies. Mr. Turner, the butchers in Victoria Street, definitely for the meat. I can't think of much else. A lot of the silverware for the dining room came from W.H. Walker & Co. in England. I can't really think of other things.
It must have been an amazing task keeping all those hotel rooms clean, feeding the guests.
Well, the chambermaid, people worked in those days, and if you had a chambermaid, one chambermaid would look after about 15 rooms. And, of course, there were no private bathrooms or anything, so they didn't have those to worry about. But certainly, on a Saturday, a chambermaid would start at about 6 o'clock in the morning, and she'd probably finish the last room by about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, so they worked very hard.
And as regards the staff, would each, who'd be supervising the work? Would you, the family, be walking around keeping an eye, or would there be heads of department?
Oh, yeah, the housekeeper would look after upstairs. My mother basically looked after downstairs, but there was a chef as well, and an under-chef. And then there would be a head still room man or woman, probably a man, head waiter, head porter. So they did look after their own staff. And the only time we were ever, shall we say, cheated on money was when we've got the first manager in. And that was when you had to start looking after the money, because up until then, you just trusted everybody. And nothing ever happened, nothing ever went missing. You know, it was just sort of... The staff were very loyal. That was what it was, basically. And the same staff all the time. He's my husband now, he'll tell you some stories.
Yeah.
But that is one thing I remember. You see that ball?
Yeah.
Well, this is the sort of thing my father would think of, you see. He'd think, what can I get that nobody else has got? So this huge ball was kept on the grass opposite to us, which was regarded as our grass sort of thing, you know. And, of course, other people would come along and pinch it. Other people from places further down would come along and you'd see it rolling along the grass, running from that. So it was a page boy's job. One of the page boy's jobs was to go and look for that ball and bring it back again. But I can remember that well.
Must have been a good advertisement. Your father, this brochure is very high quality. He obviously believed in advertising.
Oh, yes.
Can you tell me a bit about his advertising activities in the family and what they do and where?
Well, do you mean where we advertised? Simply in the Isle of Man Guide. That was all. Nothing else at all. Yo, Peter, come and tell some stories.
I'll just pause the tape. Yeah, so just talking about your father, I mean, this brochure here is unusual because obviously very few of the other guest houses would have been able to produce something so lavish.
Yeah.
He must have really believed in image, presentation, and also the modern entrance hall.
Yes, yeah. Oh, he was always sort of trying new things, you know. But what you want to try and find is someone, I don't remember a lot about it, but what happened when we took the places back after the war, because that was dreadful.
Can you remember anything about that?
No, not a lot. I really only remember what people said about it. Most of the furniture was taken out and stored at the Derby Castle, you know, with Summerland. Stored at the Derby Castle in their huge ballroom. And at the end of the war, the boarding house keepers were simply given sort of chits which said 150 wardrobes, so many this. And you went and you never got your own stuff back. And what you got back was a lot of rubbish, and sometimes you get a dressing table. I think the dressing tables were left in the houses, and you would come to open them, and there'd be nothing there except the front, you know. So the first few years, you were really just sort of scratching to get enough furniture together to keep the places running. And then, of course, we had food rationing. And
it's all right, just taking notes for me.
Mm-hmm. Okay. We had food rationing, and that was just one long start, you know, long fight. I can remember we had, I think, a party of Rotarians came in May, and our food thing came through, and it was about 4 days after they'd arrived, you know, due to arrive, and I rang up government office and I said, these people are here, or they're coming, and then what about it? Oh, you can't have it, they said. So we got it, of course, you know, we just fought for it. But then you had to collect all the coupons from the visitors, count them all, send them all in, fill in forms. I don't think they ever were counted when they got. I mean, I used to be fairly careful, but I don't think for 1 minute they were ever checked.
Did you ever have to turn to the black market to make ends meet?
No, not the time, during the war, but that was just family. But not not after the war, I don't think. Can't remember we ever did, no. I mean, the people got what they were entitled to pretty well. I don't know whether you could have got black market stuff. I know during the war we got jam from somewhere.
I can see that the improvements to the place must have been done a lot over the years. Can you remember improvements being done to the building and new things being added, like...
Well, the lift.
The heating or the lift.
The lift was a big thing. There was no central heating. I think there were a couple of bathrooms put in. Not really. Once the place had been turned into the six houses had all been turned into one, the kitchens would be redone. But basically there was no alterations to the actual building. I think the reception hall was made, the reception desk was made bigger by going backwards into the yard. But there was very little. I mean, there wasn't a lot you could change. They changed it after we sold it, I believe. But I never went in, so I don't know what they did to it.
Mm. And, sorry, I forgot what I was going to say. You were just saying about the beach ball, and I can see we've got the beach ball and there's the dance hall. So there's obviously a real sort of atmosphere that the place had its own go-ahead image.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
What other sort of things would be used to keep the visitors entertained and happy?
Well, there was dancing, if you can read sort of what they were supposed to do every day, and there was dancing every night. There were competitions, there were dance competitions, there was a cabaret. People would meet people and sort of say, we'll meet up, you know, and they'd... But they went out quite a lot, you see. They went out, there was the Derby Castle, there was the Palace, there was the Palais de Danse, there were all the cinemas. And a lot of people would go down on the beach. I mean, the beach was absolutely packed. They were quite happy just to do that. It was, you know, I suppose people didn't go abroad for holidays. To see the sea was something, and nobody worried about how much sewage was coming in or anything like that. I mean, we played on that shore all my life. And now people say, oh, you can't take the children on the beach because of the sewage dam. None of those problems.
I can see there's a coach to Kirkbraddon was provided for the open air service.
Yes, yes.
Did the hotel have its own coach or did you hire one?
No, we had them. We had them. They were Shimmons Garage coaches from next door but one, so... No, we had them.
And they've got, there's a dance competition and a weekly trophy.
Oh, yes. Oh, yeah. They did all that. And my niece was telling me that she doesn't remember, but she remembers being told that before the war, you actually got changed in the evening and wore long dresses and this sort of thing. It was much more formal than it is now.
So what sort of social background do you think the visitors were? Because dealing with the correspondents, did you get a feel for whether they were working class, middle class?
Well, working to middle class. A lot of they had the, you know, each town would have its own holiday period of a fortnight, so... the ones you didn't want were the Scottish ones, but the others would be, there'd be 1 week it would be Burnley, you know, and then Rotherham, all those places around there, and they would all come at the same time. So a lot of them would probably know each other.
What sort of jobs would your visitors be doing, do you think, back home?
Something I really don't know. Mm. I don't know sort of what industries there were, probably mills, a lot of them, I would think.
You're trying to feel, with it having a more upmarket image than some of the guest houses, whether it was sort of more the office workers rather than the shop floor, or was it just large and they managed, and your father managed to, and yourself created a very good image?
I would think that they certainly weren't upper class, I would have said. Working to middle class, I'd have thought. I mean, a lot of the places around us were all sort of exactly the same. The Metropole, West Lakes, all along that block, they were all fairly big places.
And how would your end, the sort of Crescent end, compare with the Lock Promenade end? You were bigger houses, so did you have different clientele?
No, I wouldn't have thought so. I would have thought that the people who went to Lock Promenade might be a little bit disappointed that they didn't have the seashore opposite to them, that's all. But I mean, I would say probably a lot of people who came didn't know what they were going to. You know, we had the advantage of probably being the quieter end of the promenade, where you could just sort of walk across and you had the grass in front of you. I mean, people used to sunbathe over there.
And thinking of, say, for example, somewhere like the Savoy, how would you compare with the Savoy?
The Savoy was the one just opposite to the Castle Mona. They were friends of ours. About the same... Rigby's, yeah.
We've interviewed them.
Yeah, yeah. I went to school with Pat Rigby, yes. About the same. Be the same sort of clans.
That's helpful. Do you recall any characters among the staff over the years, or trouble you had with the people?
Well, we had summer, the Irish staff reckoned that we'd got a devil in the kitchen, so we had to get the Irish priest to come down and exorcise it. We had that.
Can you tell me more about that?
No, I can't remember. That's all there was to it. The Irish staff said they were going home if they couldn't get rid of this, whatever it was, in the kitchen. So the priest came down and sprinkled some holy water, and that was that. And then I was telling Reddy's, I always remember we had a man we called the Pan Man, the Potato Man. And the Potato Man, poor soul, came from Ireland, and he had his hands on the wrong way round. So instead of holding something like that, for him to do that, he had to do that, you see.
Cross his hands.
Yeah, but he was very happy. And he sat doing his potatoes all day, perfectly happy. And at the end of the summer, you know, my father would call the staff together and he'd say, now, you know, half of you will be going home in about a fortnight and this, that and the other. But the Pan Man would never go. And he was the last one to leave, and we literally had to more or less take him down and put him on the boat because he didn't want to go home. But the fire at the Metropole was something. That was, I think, in the winter. It was... We weren't living in the hotel at the time. We had a house in Brunswick Road. It must have been in the winter. And I got a phone call from a housekeeper who was living at the Alex. And they said the Metropole has gone on fire. And Peter was out at a round table do. And I had two young children. My father was in Italy. I remember meeting up a friend to come and babysit, and I went down.
What sort of year would this be?
Oh, gosh.
Well, how old would you be?
Well, about 60-something it would be, in the 60s. And I went down and I thought, the thing we've got to get out are the books, you know, because it was a real good blaze. And I remember sitting on the railings of the promenade listening to the lift drop from the top of the Metropole down to the floor. Well, that was a good blaze, that. But we were all right, we just had a bit of smoke damage, you know, in the higher rooms. But the fire people came into the Alexandra to go upstairs to get onto our roof to put the fire hoses down onto the Metropole. But I don't really remember an awful lot.
Do you ever remember the guests getting up to anything particularly scandalous?
No, not really. I can remember, personally, throwing two or three young men out of the place because he put a cigarette on the floor and put his foot on it. And I threw them out straight away. No, I can't really remember. Maybe something were rowdy and this sort of thing. Don't remember much drunkenness at all. I don't think people really got drunk in those days. Don't remember it.
And when you came into the full management of the business yourself, when your father retired, how old would you have been then?
Oh, I never did. We all retired together. He didn't retire until the place was sold pretty well.
So he must have been...
He was about 60... About 67, 68, something like that. He took it a little bit easier, but basically he was still the boss. Yeah.
And how did the Douglas Bay fit into the picture? Were you always at the Alexandra?
Yes. And my brother always at the Bay. Yes, the two places had nothing to do with each other. They probably ordered things like dining room stuff and that sort of thing. They probably ordered them together, but nothing else at all. Yeah.
And your other sister?
She died when she was very young. Sorry. Yeah.
So did you live in the hotel yourself?
Yes, up until... we had a house for 1 year, which was sold when war broke out. That was on Glencrutchery Road, but then in about About 1948, we bought the old thatch at the bottom of Brunswick Road, and we lived there in the winter. But when I was a child, we lived at the Alexandria, yes. You'd imagine you could have as many bedrooms as you wanted in the winter. I used to move quite frequently. But it was cold. It was very cold.
What was it like the winter after the busy summer season in terms of the mood?
Well, I can't remember. I was at school. My father played golf an awful lot. And we'd go for a holiday in January. We'd go somewhere like the south of France, or I remember we went skiing once. But that would be in January. But then when you came back, once it got to the end of January, you were working because the post was coming in. And you were thinking about spring cleaning and that sort of thing. So you really only got, October, November, December, 3 months off. But what we were talking about one day was, quite recently, was, this would be when I was a child, is all the blankets were washed and taken across the road and pegged down with stones and left to dry in the sun. Has anybody else told you that? Yes? It's the sort of thing people remember. And how many people were there in the tourist board? About 10 or something. Yeah. Not the same as it was.
Did you notice the trade changing over the years? You retired in about 1962 when you sold the business. Had you noticed it beginning to change or fall off by then? Or not?
No, not by then. Staff were getting a bit harder, I think. No, I don't think so. Not really. I think that was the time when they had the thing going, what was it called, something, or whether they were trying to extend the season. But it was never going to work.